Welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Hi, I'm Irene Watson, and I'm your host for today. I'm delighted to be speaking on the phone with George Doherty. He is the author of Crisis in the American Heartland, Disasters and Mental Health in Rural Environments, an introduction, Volume 1. George tells me that there are at least four or five other volumes coming, and they all will have to do with some aspects of rural health. Today we're going to be talking with George about issues that arise in rural communities, many times due to the remoteness and cultural differences. He also has some ideas on how things have been changing and will continue to change. But first, a little bit about George. George Doherty resides in Laramie, Wyoming, where he founded the Rocky Mountain Region Disaster Mental Health Institute. He is currently employed as the president, CEO of this organization, and also serves as a clinical coordinator of the Snowy Range Critical Incident Stress Management Team. He has been involved with disaster relief since 1995, serving as a disaster mental health specialist with such incidences as the UP train wreck in Laramie, Hurricane Fran in North Carolina, the Cincinnati floods in Falmont, Kentucky, and the tropical storm Allison in southeast Texas. George is a licensed professional counselor in private practice and has been an adjunct instructor for a number of colleges, including Northern Nevada Community College, Warren National University, and the University of Wyoming. Hi, George.
Good morning.
So glad to be talking to you, because coming from a rural area myself at one time, I realized that there are a lot of issues that do occur in those areas. And so what I'd like you to do is just explain to our listening audience some of the things that actually go on that are of concern and are addressed in your book.
In the area of disasters in rural areas, there are some differences, and I think just recently on the news I've been watching with some of the flooding in the Midwest, it kind of points that out, some areas that people are not aware of. In many urban areas, they do have flooding in urban areas, but in rural areas there's a lot of things like floods from rivers and streams that back up sometimes, and fires, and I know you've got some fires down in the Texas area going on right now that are pretty bad, and then those wildfires are impact farmers and ranchers especially. We don't have too many problems with earthquakes and things, but in some areas there are. Hurricanes and tornadoes in particular, and again, that's one that's just pointed itself out in places like just in the last couple of weeks in Mississippi and Alabama with some of the tornadoes there. Urban areas are sometimes affected by those, and sometimes we don't hear about the smaller towns that are in rural environments. The other part of the book deals with, in the beginning, the differences in what I call culture, the culture of rurality. Mm-hmm. That's a hard word to pronounce.
Mm-hmm.
Rural culture between in ranching communities and ranching states and farming states is different in a lot of ways than it is in urban areas. What we call frontier states, I know it sounds like something out of the Old West, but in a way it is. We have states like Wyoming and Utah and Montana and Nevada and Alaska and Oregon and Idaho and places like that, where there's vast rural areas that people live in. And one of the things that we discuss later on in the book is the needs there for some of the, not just for disaster mental health areas, but also for mental health generally and for medical people, personnel. There's a real shortage of that in rural areas, and this has been a traditional shortage in a lot of ways. In some places it has been filled partially by public health personnel and nursing people and medical practitioners such as physician's assistants and mental health professionals of various professions. But one of the things that they are up against a lot is keeping people that are come in for there to perform these functions. I can give a personal example for that. I worked for the state of Nevada in eastern rural Nevada for about 7 years back in the 80s. And used to travel about 500 miles a week besides what I did in the town that I was in, which was only about 5,000 people, and every other town between there and places like Reno or Vegas and Salt Lake City was smaller. So, but the nursing personnel that they could get to stay for any period of time came primarily at that time from the Philippines, because it's pretty hard to get people to stay in rural areas. We have a similar situation here in Wyoming where we don't have as many doctors as we would like to have for our areas. It's not that the service isn't good, but it's hard to keep people because in our rural environments, like I say, it's a bit of a different culture. If you know anything about ranching or farming, maybe you're going to, or come from a ranching or farming family or state, you probably know a little bit more about how to fit in, and that's good, because hopefully, you know, we can keep people who go through that and go through, like, medical school or become psychologists. But compared to urban areas, there's not a lot of the same things. You have to travel for certain things. The amenities aren't quite the same. And you have to travel long distances sometimes to get some things. And I kind of stop here before I go too far.
Yeah, well, you know, and I can really relate to what you're talking about, because when I lived in Canada, I lived in a rural community. And it was very difficult to have medical staff come in. It was, you know, mental health. It seemed that the medical doctors would come, or the dentists, or any of those professions, and they would stay a short time, and then they'd leave again, because really, you know, they were probably the city folk that weren't really used to living in a rural community and didn't understand. And it was just But culturally, it is different. You know, living in a small community, yes, we create our own culture, but it's really hard to break into it.
Well, yes, you know, it takes, if you're not from the area, or you can't, you know, mm-hmm. quote unquote, speak the language, yeah. or know something about the background, it's hard to break into it, and that makes it hard for people, as you say, from urban areas that come there, well-meaning people.
Yeah,
but it's hard to break into the culture, and like I said, you know, like folks who are come from the city or are used to certain amenities and things,
exactly.
like museums and recreational things and other stuff, is a different lifestyle.
Yeah,
you know, and it takes some time. And Canada, yeah, I know a little bit about Canada in that way too, because there's a lot of, especially out in the western part of the country, in like Alberta and Saskatchewan,
Manitoba, exactly. Yeah.
Yes,
and the same thing goes too. Is, you know, when there's a disaster, and I'm relating back to when the town that we lived in, the river flooded.
Mm-hmm.
And although, you know, there was some preparation, there just wasn't enough resources to stop this flood. Eventually they built berms and so on, but at the beginning it was just, there was always panic. Every year there was a panic because the resources weren't there.
Right, and that's, I think, you know, if you follow this at all, you know, over the last number of years in particular, the last 10, 15 years, they've been trying to address a lot of that, the Red River of the North in the Dakotas and over near Minnesota there. They have, because that's one of the few rivers that flows north, actually, and when they have the snow melts there at this time of year, it can get pretty dicey at times. And currently, too, as I said, you know, the Mississippi is at a very high flood stage. I think it's the highest, from what I heard, since the 1937 floods,
yeah.
which were pretty devastating. down there, but they've tried a lot of things with the putting in levees and things, and they have levees up also in the Dakotas, which, you know, you kind of associate levees because of the sounding or whatever with the South, but it's also in the North.
So what do you think would needs to change so that there is that shift and more of the resources, the people that, let's say, in the medical field or the mental health field could actually be enticed to go into these areas and do their work?
Well, some things that could, you know, one, of course, is salary. Oh, that's always a factor no matter where you're at. The other part is for training. For example, with mental health personnel and medical personnel, to at least have either an internship or something in a rural area so they get some heads up on things before they actually commit to a place and things. But one of the things that I think that would be very helpful, and I've spoken about this for a number of years, we did away with the draft for the military after Vietnam, okay? You know, and it certainly needed some changes, and you know, but I think that if we had program of some type of public service, for example, and it wouldn't have to be military necessarily, it could be. It could also be in the medical profession or in the mental health profession, where after someone gets their, you know, their degree, they put in 2 years of service, and they can do this in urban or rural areas. But if they want to serve in a rural area, they can get a picture of it by spending maybe a year or two working in a small community. Now, I think the old VISTA programs and AmeriCorps and some of those have attempted that with certain groups, but they don't often find it with professional organizations and professional groups. And when I worked for the state of Nevada, they had at that time a very good program for working with rural mental health. And the system that they had set up there, and I think it's still basically the same in this regard, the rural clinics mental health center was all of the counties in rural Nevada, with the exceptions of Washoe County and Reno and Clark County, Las Vegas. They're under a different system. And it worked out very well. It had a very good system going for that. And they had psychiatrists that were consulting there at the time from the University of Utah and also University of Nevada, Reno at that time. Now, if a system like that could be set up, especially in our rural areas, to provide, you know, opportunities for people to get their feet wet before they jump in and find out it's not really what I want. You know, it gives them a chance to make an appropriate decision. It takes special people, you know, to work in this environment, just like it takes a special person to work in a disaster mental health type environment. Everybody feels they want to contribute something, and that's good, and there are ways they can, but how they do it is important, you know, and what background and what exposure do they have. You can't just say, hey, I want to go help out and jump in and go. You know, it takes a little bit of training, and I think we need to give more training in this regard in our colleges and universities.
Well, it seems to me that, in fact, I know that right after 9/11, there were quite a few grants that were available to train people as first responders or second responders for, you know, disasters. And I did take some workshops, and this was more on the spiritual, so that, and this was by one of the local organizations, so that, you know, when this disaster happened, that a group of spiritual leaders can go in and help them, you know, help. But one of the things that they really stressed is we really had to learn the culture of each type of an individual, you know, all the different types of religions and how to handle their faith, because I could come in with one faith and I may be talking to somebody that is a totally, you know, opposite from me, but I have to acknowledge who they are and still be able to speak on the same language. And I think that it's the same thing as what you're talking about.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Because one of the groups that did and still does a lot of good responses is, of course, the American Red Cross.
Right.
They started after Hurricane Andrew with a lot of training and stuff for people in some of the early disaster mental health field areas, and bringing in trained counselors and mental health professionals to not only be trained in it but also work in it. And a lot of the faith-based groups that work in disasters, there's a whole list of them. I've deployed over the years in a number of situations with, and have been exposed to quite a few of them. And they're, a lot of them, the ones who are really, you know, into it and have taken the time to do, as you say, you know, get to know what happens in a disaster before going into it, I think do a very good job. An example on the East Coast, and this is one I kind of grew up with. I grew up in Pennsylvania, and I'm very familiar with the Amish or Pennsylvania Dutch, you know, whatever you call them. They contribute a lot of their effort in terms of disaster recovery. In fact, there's some of them, I believe, that have been working with the recovery after Katrina down there and building houses and things, because they're experts at this. And they go down and, you know, they do it and are very well accepted usually. There's another group of people that works with children, and I think it's the Church of the Brethren, if I'm not mistaken, that does that. There's other groups that are out there. You may recall when Tropical Storm Allison hit southeast Texas not too many years ago. Time flies. But I worked down in Atascocita, Texas is.
Uh-huh.
Near, you know, down near Houston area.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And I worked in as a mental health professional in one of the shelters they had there. And one of the groups that they brought in after the flooding from that one was a group of Spanish speaking people that I had never encountered before. And their origins were actually, if I remember correctly, they were originally Cuban in background and were a different religion themselves. So it took, and they mostly spoke Spanish, and it took a little while to get into that and break in.
Okay.
So you have to be, you have to think on your feet sometimes, and you have to be flexible and willing to learn.
Well, exactly, and not put in your own thoughts or beliefs or faith into it,
exactly.
But acknowledge who they are. One of the things, too, I found that, you know, I'm reflecting back to living in a small rural community, was the lack of privacy. And especially when it came to mental health issues, it just seems to me there was such a stigma that anybody that actually needed support, you know, emotionally, they were just really sort of segregated and looked down upon, and it took a long, long time. I know many psychologists came into the area, and they came and then they left because they just were not accepted culturally in that area.
Yes, you know, in rural environments, farming communities, ranching communities, there's a long history of, you know, we take care of our own, and that's a good thing, basically, but outsiders who come in sometimes are looked upon a little bit, you know, with askew. You know, who are these people? Where are they coming from? And what do they, you know, what do they mean telling us what to do with our people? You know, trying to get beyond that is sometimes very difficult, and very difficult for our professionals to deal with. In our trainings from our institute that we do, one of the things we always emphasize is getting out there and getting to know people, so that when you do show up, you know, if you are from the area, and you're a professional and you show up, they know who you are. And this includes first responders as well, because if the first responders, you know, don't know who you are, as a mental health professional, for example, they're going to look at it and say, we have an expression up here. Well, we'll just cowboy up, you know, which means, you know, suck it up and move on, you know. Sometimes, you know, we definitely make sure that when we do our trainings in critical incident stress management, disaster, mental health, and related areas, that we include as many first responders in there as well, along with the mental health professionals, so they can get to know what each other are doing or talking about. And if there are exercises or trainings, for example, that FEMA might do, or Homeland Security, something, get out there as a mental health professional and get into it, and get to know, you know, how to deal with people. And the other thing is, I think, in dealing with the people directly affected by disaster, the victim, is how do you talk to them, like you say? You know,
yeah.
Can you sit down on a bale of hay or over a fence and chat?
Mm-hmm.
You know, or there was a, this is kind of an iconic and possibly a little unfair in a way, to say the following. But I had a situation. I was working a disaster, I won't say where, but it was in a primarily rural area, and there was a city, you know, fairly close by, and there were some of the mental health professionals there wanted to volunteer. And I had a man, you know, psychologist call up, you know, to the center, the shelter one day, and if he wanted to come down, help, said, sure, come on down, let's, you know, we'll talk and get out there. Well, he comes up the next day with a briefcase and a suit and tie and introduces himself and says, where's the office? And, you know, I said, let's go for a walk. I need to talk to you.
Yep.
And, you know, to his credit, for sure, okay, we talked. And I explained how, the situation, how it worked. And I said, you know, first of all, get rid of the suit and tie. You know, come on down here and maybe a pair of jeans and whatever, because it's,
yep,
a pretty muddy area. And we'll go around and we'll talk to people and stuff. So we did that. And he did it the next day. And then I think, you know, but he had no idea. He wanted to help, and that was,
yeah,
good.
Yeah.
You know, but you have to be able to talk the language.
Exactly.
And if you know how to, if you know the different breeds of cattle or sheep or and you know, how to ride a horse or something, that doesn't hurt either.
It sure doesn't. And that's where you start off with, don't you, on their own level, and where, you know, something that they can relate to first. And you bet, it's making that relationship with them first before you can actually help them.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Inside Scoop Live is a global internet-based broadcast specializing in interviewing published authors about their current books and areas of expertise. I'm Juanita Watson, the host of the show, and invite you to join me as I bring to the air both well-known and upcoming writers. You will hear my guests talk candidly about their books, their life experience, specific topics, and the business of being an author in today's literary world. Always interesting and current, my intention is to bring our audience high-quality discussions that spotlight a vast diversity of authors in the field today. Our interviews are syndicated and archived for availability 24/7 through direct podcast and MP3 download. And as always, I love to hear from listeners. Have a look at our website, InsideScoopLive.com. Send me an email, comment on previous guests, and let me know who you'd like to hear on the show. I'll do my best to bring you your favorite authors live and direct.
Welcome back to Inside Scoop Live. Today I'm talking with George Doherty. He is the author of Crisis in the American Heartland, Disasters and Mental Health in Rural Environments. As if you've heard so far, George is giving us a glimpse into what happens in rural communities during times of disaster and crisis. Stay tuned, because the rest of the interview is just as informative. And by the way, George's website address is rmrinstitute.org. What about, George, what about the aftercare for, let's say, first responders? You know, I mean, first responders are trained. They go into disaster areas. They go in, let's say, into these rural areas that they may be trained for, maybe not. It's a disaster. Now, so they leave. What kind of aftercare do these people really need?
The first responders?
The first responders after they leave, yeah.
Well, one of the things that we teach here and through our institute is a process that involves what we refer to as a one-on-one training and for peer-to-peer, okay, to look out for your buddy. And you know him or her best, and you're working side by side with them, and you know maybe when something's a little bit different, and you can kind of chat with them. And what do you do if you see that they're having problems? Who do you refer to? And again, that's, you know, if the organization has contact with people, like a critical incident stress management team. And we've tried to develop some of those up here. We've got about 3 or 4 of them in the state. I'm the clinical coordinator for one here in Laramie, Albany County, in the southeast part of the state. The other part is we do something that's called a debriefing. And with some people, this is controversial because some people feel that, you know, that maybe it makes the situation worse instead of better. Some people feel that they need to do therapy right away with somebody who's having a problem, a first responder. And one of the things we say is, hey, you know, we're not there to do therapy, number one. We're there to listen and let people ventilate a little and get some stuff out. We're dealing with stress, and we're dealing with something that we call psychological first aid. And this isn't covered directly in this book. It's in some of our other books. But the psychological first aid is pretty much the same kind of concept like you would have with physical first aid. You know, you have an injury that occurs on the job. You administer first aid, and then you do a triage type thing. You're not going to do surgery for a cut finger, you know. But you're going to put a Band-Aid on it, and you know, if it's lucky, they might be able to go back to work with the cut finger. If it's more serious, then you need to refer them to a medical doctor for some further assistance, or a nurse. For example, they have a broken arm or a broken leg, or they have a puncture wound or something like this, they're bleeding severely, you know, that's when you go for the more severe thing, surgery or whatever it is. In mental health area, we do a similar type thing, and that's what we try to teach our first responders as well as our mental health professionals, is to do kind of a triage with the person, okay? We don't do therapy there, okay? We do a triage and we assess the situation. And if the person is doing okay, and if they can, you know, in the judgment of the person doing the assessment, can get back to work, fine. If not, then we refer them to for a more serious thing. But we don't do that on the scene because that is beyond the scope of what we're there for. We're there to do psychological first aid, and in a sense, it's like putting a Band-Aid on or referring them to somebody else for therapy later. And not everybody needs to go to therapy, okay? Just because you've been working in a disaster scene doesn't mean you necessarily need therapy. Most people that work those things have a lot of training and a lot of exposure and a lot of strength and know how to handle some stuff and get on with things without, you know, they may need to talk to somebody every once in a while, but a peer, you know, or somebody like that. And that's why we do with the debriefings, we do it in a group session, and we do it with the people that responded to it. For example, if we had a pretty severe auto crash or a fire, you know, situation, or if there's a death involved somewhere, we get called in and we send in a team, and it's usually about 3 of us that do this. In our team here, we have 3 people that usually go, a mental health person like myself, a peer coordinator, somebody who's one of the peer, like a law enforcement person who's been trained in these procedures, and maybe a nurse or maybe a chaplain. It depends on, you know, on the situation. And we try to, and then we spend time talking with them about it. And we try to do it from the peer level there when we're doing it, and keep mental health in there, but not necessarily put mental health at the foreground. And again, it's a matter of speaking the language.
Right. Yeah. And you know, you said something very important, that these people are trained. They are trained, and there's a reason why they are in these positions. But they're also humans, and so being able to talk about it later is really important.
Definitely.
I think that these are some important things for us who may need that first responder at some point.
Definitely. We don't want to, that's why we do it. We don't want to lose them in the future.
Exactly.
They're valuable people. And you know, there's another part, too, that I wanted to tell you about here, too, that I usually we do the training with that relates to this. Acute stress is something that we can see very easily. You know, the like firefighter at the Oklahoma City bombing, their famous photo, carrying a child out, and something like that. That's an acute stress situation. But there's also something called cumulative stress.
Mm-hmm.
And here's where the rural part comes in handy, because I usually give the example. I tell them, you know, I was raised as a farm boy, okay? And we, you know, out by the barn on the side, we had a little spigot on the side of the barn there that sometimes would drip, especially in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
And trying to save some water or whatever, you know, my mom would always tell me, make sure the bucket's under the spigot.
Right. Well, I hear you. I understand all that.
Yeah. And, you know, it drip, drip, drip. Mm-hmm. You know, each drop by itself is not very big. Doesn't do very much, but pretty soon that bucket fills up and you get one drop comes in and the bucket overflows.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that one drop by itself may be insignificant, and you know, people will look at it and say, hey, come on, you know, cowboy up, or you know, buck up, whatever, you know, that was only a small thing, it's not a big thing, why are you getting upset? Well, one thing I tell them is, because it's been building all these years. You know, and all the work that you do all the time, you keep a lot of it inside. And that's another reason why we do the talk thing with the debriefings, to, you know, get them to get it out and feel more comfortable talking with their buddies, at least, about what's been going on, so they can, you know, if something does come up, they can talk to them about it also, and try to keep that one drop from getting too big.
So, George, do you think that there's hope for the rural areas to make some shifts? And for it to be a little differently than what it is now?
For people in rural areas to see how to... Oh, well, definitely, yes. There's always hope, number one.
Mm-hmm.
But and the thing about it is I've seen a lot of change in direction and approach and things in rural areas. Our extension agents, when I was a kid, I was in 4-H and stuff like that, and used to did a lot of work with, you know, as a kid, but the extension agents from the land-grant universities are out there in communities already. There are other farm groups and ranch groups that are out there also, you know, Future Farmers of America, the Farm Bureau, other groups like that. That have a lot of experience and background and things, and people listen to them. And if there are trained personnel in those groups, and talk to the ranchers and farmers, but a lot of our ranchers and farmers today, too, are college educated as well, so they've been exposed to a lot of other things.
Yeah.
You know, so I mean, it's not like it was maybe back in the 30s or so, or back in the days of the other, you know, before that.
Mm-hmm.
But in a lot of cases, too, they're very isolated still. And I think the family values of ranchers and farmers are important things. There's a strength in the groups that are around them, like the religious groups that they are involved with, or other groups that are around, you know, rodeo groups and farmers and ranchers have a tradition of getting together at least once a year, usually for a county fair or something like that, to see things. And that's been the traditional way over the centuries, over the years, where new things are learned and stuff. And it's just a matter, again, of talking and listening. Listening is an important part.
That's the first part, isn't it? Listen and then talk. So.
Yes, definitely.
Gosh, this has been a really interesting conversation, and I know that your heart is right in this particular topic, and, you know, you living in a rural area yourself, and obviously, you know, you went to Baylor University and North Texas University, and so you were out there. You weren't, you know, just always in the community that you're in.
Right.
And it's obviously there's a passion for you to be in a rural community.
Well, yes. A colleague of mine wrote a foreword for the book where he said something that surprised me a little bit. He said, "I work in rural areas," I'm paraphrasing it now, "for more years than I care to admit." And I guess maybe there's some truth. I don't know, because my undergraduate major helps sometimes, too, is in animal science.
Yeah.
And that one I got from Penn State. And I guess, if I'm going to be fair to all the universities and places I've been, Mississippi was another place.
Mm-hmm.
But it's been very helpful, and, you know, I've never ceases to amaze me. I figure, you know, I'm always learning something new, you know, and I like talking with people in rural areas, because it seems to me they're more down to earth sometimes.
Yes, they are. And, you know, we look at the rural area as being very remote, and in reality, it really isn't. It just basically a lot of times a different culture.
Well, it what you say is true, but in some places, okay, like you go out to far west Texas, for example, or Wyoming, and rural Nevada or Alaska. You know, some of the distances do make a difference in terms of social contacts.
Yeah.
I mean, but with our new technologies.
Exactly.
That we have, I think, and Alaska was one of the pioneers in this, telemedicine and telecounseling and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's going to be a lot of help in the future for passing information around.
Exactly. And the internet has just opened up a whole world. And, you know, our world is getting much smaller because of that. And these rural areas are coming closer together. So.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I just heard something this morning. I'm sure you're familiar with Skype.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
And I guess it was Microsoft just bought them out.
Uh-huh.
And but that has had and will continue to have a strong impact on what you're saying, where people can talk face to face without having to be there physically.
Exactly. I just interviewed an author yesterday from South Africa, and he used Skype. How easy was that? It was just like sitting right here, you know, across the desk from him, talking to him. So,
yes, it's fascinating. My nephew is stationed in South Korea right now, and he calls, you know, he's on Skype back and forth a lot with his son and his wife and stuff. So it is amazing. But that, I think, does make a difference. Now, there's still a need for personal contact face to face.
Yes.
However, a lot of that stuff can be mitigated and dealt with there in those ways. And I think, and the culture that you mentioned, it's important to get to know that as well.
For sure, for sure. Well, gosh, George, this has been really, it's just been fun talking, because coming from a rural area myself at one time and now living in a city with, you know, it was just totally different. And I can relate to many of the experiences I've had there, and some were good, and specifically raising children in a small rural community. I just felt much safer. You know, that's one thing for sure. So there are some benefits to living in a small
rural community. Just as long as the cow doesn't step underfoot,
Yeah. Thank you very much.
And oh, you're very welcome.
Listeners, we were just talking to George Doherty, and his book, Crisis in the American Heartland, Disasters and Mental Health in Rural Environments, an Introduction, and it's Volume 1. And check it out. Anybody that lives in a rural environment or is interested in knowing more as to really what goes on when it comes to disasters and crises, this is a good book to start with. So thanks for listening, and this is Irene Watson with Inside Scoop Live. Bye for now.